Laugh after Congress passes tax and spending bill. Democrats say the bill is cruel. We'll ask a top House Democrat what they're going to do about it. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Seven states have been fighting over who should get less water now that climate change is shrinking the Colorado River. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. But a deal may be close that would avoid complicated lawsuits. Also, most satellite internet traffic goes through Elon Musk's company, Starlink. How did he build a natural monopoly? And why some religious colleges in the U.S. are merging. It is Friday, July 4th, Independence Day. On this day in 1865, the first print run of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland was published. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. In the Middle East, Israel continues to intensify its military offensive in Gaza. Hospital officials say more than 80 Palestinians were killed overnight. Meanwhile, Hamas says it is studying a proposal for new ceasefire talks with Israel. NPR's Daniel Estrin has the latest.
Officials from both Hamas and Israel say there are positive signs that both sides are ready to negotiate a ceasefire in Gaza. Israel's foreign minister said Israel wants talks as soon as possible. A person briefed on the matter, not authorized to speak about it publicly, said Israel has agreed to a 60-day ceasefire, with Hamas releasing around half of the living and dead hostages it's holding, and Israel releasing Palestinian prisoners. There would also be U.S. guarantees that during the ceasefire, the sides would discuss a final end to the war. It could take weeks of talks before a ceasefire begins. In the meantime, Israel's military is intensifying deadly strikes in Gaza. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
President Volodymyr Zelensky is denouncing Russia after the biggest overnight bombardment of Ukraine yet. The Ukrainian Air Force says Russia fired 550 drones and missiles. Kyiv was worst hit, with officials saying at least 23 people were injured. The BBC's Danny Eberhardt has details.
Cynical was how President Zelensky described the bombardment as Kyiv assesses the damage from another sleepless night. The first air alerts, he noted, began almost straight after President Trump's latest phone call with Vladimir Putin. For Mr. Zelensky, the signalling is clear. Russia will not end the war unless it faces truly large-scale pressure. Mr. Zelensky knows the US is key, but the signs aren't good. Mr. Trump chose to speak to Mr. Putin first, not Mr. Zelensky, after the White House announced it was suspending some weapons deliveries to Kyiv.
The BBC's Danny Eberhardt. President Trump kicking off a year-long celebration of the nation's 250th birthday, starting at the Iowa State Fairgrounds. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports.
America 250 is intended to be a nonpartisan celebration of the country's birthday, but the Des Moines event closely resembled a Trump campaign rally with heavily partisan messaging. Trump celebrated the fact that Republicans passed his one big beautiful bill just hours before, but was upset Democrats didn't support it.
All of the things that we've given, and they wouldn't vote only because they hate Trump. But I hate them too, you know that? So it's sort of, I hate them. I cannot stand them because I really believe they hate our country. You want to know the truth?
He also promoted the bill's policies. At one point, talking about new estate tax changes, Trump referred to some bankers as Shylocks, an anti-Semitic slur. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, Des Moines.
This is NPR News. If your holiday destination is France, it's going to be complicated. About 40% of flights at Paris airports have been canceled due to a strike by French air traffic controllers. Flights in Nice, Marseille, and some other cities are also affected. While Broadway is a highly unionized workplace, Off-Broadway is less so. So it's of note that one of New York's most important nonprofit Off-Broadway institutions, the Public Theater and the Stagehands Union, announced a tentative agreement this week. This is the Stagehands' first contract as they voted just a year ago to join the union. Jeff London has the story.
If membership votes to ratify, the agreement will go into effect on September 1st and will include wage increases and other benefits. It will cover 100 production workers at the Public Theater, from props people to carpenters to electricians. The theater is celebrating two significant milestones this year. It's the 50th anniversary of A Chorus Line, the hit show which ran for 15 years on Broadway.
One, singular sensation.
And it's the 10th anniversary of the mega hit Hamilton.
I am not throwing away my shot.
Both shows have provided significant royalties to allow the public to develop new work and put on free Shakespeare in the Park every summer. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Wall Street is closed for the 4th of July holiday, ending yesterday with robust gains. The S&P 500 rose 0.8%, setting an all-time high. The Dow added 344 points. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science.
I had no idea of the scope or breadth of what the military was, but knowing how they all worked together, didn't have a clue.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
I'm Eric Alness, and I'm a veteran. My career started in 1986 when I went off to the Military Intelligence School at Fort Huachuca, Arizona for 6 months to become an intelligence officer. When I came back, I joined the Minnesota National Guard. I started out as in an intelligence role within an infantry battalion. Then an opportunity came up during Desert Storm in the early 90s where they were standing up the family program within the Minnesota National Guard. And it was a great opportunity to look at how do you sustain a force and watch out for the welfare of the soldiers and their families. And having families involved with their soldiers, making the soldiers even better because they knew that their family understood what they're going through and what they need to do to be successful.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
On this Independence Day, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, we'll hear about a college racing competition that runs on solar power. But first, President Trump is getting the Independence Day signing ceremony he's been demanding.
This is for the mega bill he and Republicans in Congress pushed over the finish line yesterday afternoon. Speaking under the wing of Air Force One as he departed for a victory rally in Iowa, Trump said the celebration would include a military aircraft flyover.
And it's going to be a great day. So we'll be signing with those beautiful planes flying right over our heads.
The One Big Beautiful Bill, as President Trump has been calling it, contains the president's entire domestic legislative agenda.
With more, we're joined now by NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith. So, Tam, what is the president saying about this bill's passage?
Well, as you might imagine, he and his allies are taking a victory lap. Trump was in Iowa last night for a rally and said with this bill, he kept every major promise he made to voters when he ran for office last year.
Very simply, the One Big Beautiful Bill would deliver the strongest border on earth, the strongest economy on earth, the strongest military on earth, and ensure the United States of America will remain the strongest country anywhere on this beautiful planet of ours.
Trump was, to borrow a word he likes to use, rather braggadocious about his success last night, asking, has anybody ever had a better 2 weeks?
Now, 48 hours ago, though, there was some drama. I mean, it looked like that bill and the president's timeline were in trouble. So what happened?
Well, there were quite a few Republican holdouts, but President Trump turned on the charm and then he turned up the pressure. And ultimately, all but two Republicans in the House who had been holding out folded. At a press conference after the bill passed, Majority Leader Steve Scalise gave Trump all the credit.
Donald Trump absolutely was our closer, and Donald Trump never stopped. Every day was there in the fight. Who do I need to call? What do I need to do? No president more directly engaged.
This was a pivotal moment in Trump's presidency, and he and his party rose to it. It took all-night debates and arm twisting and passed with incredibly narrow margins in both the House and the Senate. And the question now is whether it becomes a long-term political win or more of an albatross.
Oh, okay. Sounds like you're talking about the midterm elections.
Indeed. Next year, Republicans in swing districts will have to defend their votes. And so far, public polling has found this bill to be pretty unpopular. Democrats have had a lot of success in branding it as a tax cut for the rich at the expense of the poor and the vulnerable. A senior White House official conceded in a call yesterday with reporters that the president and Republicans are going to have to educate the public on what's actually in the bill, including things that are popular, like no tax on tips or expanding the child tax credit. And another thing to watch is the Medicaid cuts in the bill, which an independent analysis found would cause nearly 12 million people to lose coverage. Those will phase in more slowly, which may give Republicans some political cover, because people often don't draw a direct line between things happening in their lives and something politicians in Washington passed years earlier.
Yeah, now, still a lot of uncertainty, though. Various global conflicts, the U.S. tariff policy. What challenges lie ahead, though?
Well, it depends on how you feel about tariffs. Early next week, Trump's tariff pause is set to end, and his administration has not had much success striking trade deals. So he says he's just going to start sending letters to countries telling them how high their tariffs will be going forward. Economists say tariffs are going to hit American consumers, but Trump is unconcerned. Trump is also burning up the phones to various world leaders trying to wind down the conflicts in Gaza and Ukraine. And then there's Iran. All of which is to say, a president's work is never done.
NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Key, thanks.
You're welcome.
Now that we've heard how the White House and congressional Republicans are celebrating their big legislative win, let's hear from the Democrats. Representative Catherine Clark of Massachusetts is the Democratic whip, meaning she's the top leader just behind Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, and she's with us on the line now. Good morning, Congresswoman. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Michelle.
So Leader Hakeem Jeffries gave a marathon speech against the Republicans' bill for more than 8 hours yesterday. He called the bill disgusting, an abomination, which is an opinion, frankly, shared by many Democrats and some Republicans. And polls have found that more people oppose the bill than support it. And yet, here we are. The president plans to sign the bill today. Why do you think the Democrats weren't able to stop it when they had public opinion on their side?
Because the currency for the House Republicans is they care about one constituent, and that's Donald Trump. And at the end of the day, despite all their misgivings, all the lies that have been peddled about the benefits of this bill, they put aside their very real concerns about kicking 17 million people off of health care, and they voted to show their loyalty to Donald Trump. And on the 4th of July, when we celebrate our freedom and fighting for opportunity for everyone, the idea that they have shackled American families with a high cost of living and are going to further drive up their costs of health care and food and erode their public schools, and all the while adding $4 trillion to our national debt, is just, it is such a cruel irony that they are signing this bill when we should be celebrating our independence.
So for clarity, the Congressional Budget Office, which is this nonpartisan group that scores the bill, said it's about 12 million people would lose their health insurance at some point, and they added those deficit increases at about $3.3 trillion, which is still big, but just for clarity, those are the numbers that I think people have heard more often than that. Republican Congressman Mike Lawler of New York told All Things Considered he thinks Americans will like the bill in the long run. Let's listen to what he said.
When people are actually getting tax cuts, it will be extremely popular among the working class and the middle class and the folks who are going to benefit exceptionally well from the provisions within this bill.
So, Congressman, how are you going to deal with the fact that Americans will see tax cuts before next year's midterms and many of the cuts to their benefits only after the midterms?
You know, there are some tax cuts, and we would have loved to have a discussion about how we can reform our tax policy so that it works for working people. But that's not what this bill does. There are some short-term tax cuts, but it will never offset the damage they have done. $1 trillion out of Medicaid, $500 billion after Medicare. Those were promises that Donald Trump and the Republican made to never touch those programs. And it goes so much deeper. I have heard from constituents, you know, there's one mom named Nancy and her son Charlie, who's dependent on Medicaid for Charlie's disabilities, to be able to have a wheelchair, to have aids. And with Medicaid's help, he is learning to walk. They have just ripped that away from that family and millions of other families. And, you know, the cuts are not only to Medicaid, but to the ACA, closing hospitals. There are 330 hospitals that they have just put in real jeopardy. That's not only access to healthcare, especially for rural America. Those are jobs. They're often the largest employer in a region. So this bill overall is, I cannot overstate the cruelty and what is going to happen to the American people as these provisions take place.
I understand, but what I'm asking you is, how are you going to talk about this going forward? Look, I understand that the Democrats are looking to the midterms, as they logically would. I mean, the president's party has lost the House majority in, what, 4 of the past 5 midterm elections, including the most recent 3. So it's logical that the Democrats would look toward the midterms, but what I'm asking you is, how are you going to talk about that when the actual pain of this is unlikely to be felt before the midterms, where the benefits are likely to be felt or may be felt?
You know, I think that they are going to feel this. We're already seeing hospitals that are saying, looking ahead at Medicaid reimbursement, they are looking to close. We've already seen reports of that. And House Democrats are going to spend every day of the next 16 months talking to moms and dads and seniors and veterans, so that they know that Republicans just took away their health care, raised their energy bills, and hiked their grocery costs. And we're going to continue doing our shadow hearings, going into communities across this country, talking about this bill and what its impact is going to be. And our vision for Americans, where we give them the tools for success, so that they can build a life of dignity. That's what Democrats are going to be doing. This is not what the American people voted for, and they are not going to forget this outright betrayal.
Let me mention, we've invited many Republican lawmakers to talk about the bill, especially members who came around to supporting it after first raising objections to it. I want to say that those invitations remain open. But to that end, a recent NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll found Republicans largely approve of the job their own party is doing in Congress, while Democrats are evenly divided. Only 44% of Democrats said they approve of congressional Democrats. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think we are living in a time where it is very difficult in Washington, that it is a winner-take-all system. And what we are doing, what we are building with the American people, is going out into their communities, holding the town halls, making sure that we are doing hearings that are there so that we can make the case for the American people, that we see you. We want you to have a fair shot at the American dream.
Okay. That is House Democratic Whip Catherine Clark. She's a Democrat from Massachusetts. Whip Clark, Congresswoman Clark, I hope you'll come back and talk more about this. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It is 6:19. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock this morning, Kari Hedlund will bring you Headwaters, a great mix of music, and 10 o'clock, Minnesota Mixtape with Malachi Coons. Support comes from Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji, offering hot tubs, pool tables, saunas, and more. Learn more online at hottubsmn.com. Partly sunny today with highs in the upper 80s. There's a chance for scattered showers and thunderstorms throughout today, breezy south winds. And tonight, showers, possible thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 60s. And for tomorrow, chance of showers, again, possible thunderstorms, especially in the afternoon. Otherwise, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 80s. The McCroskey Art Center presents its annual Downtown Art Fair Saturday, July 12th from 9 to 4 on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids with over 40 regional artists, food vendors, hands-on activities, and live music. And the Park Rapids Water Ski Team performs Saturday, July 12th at 6 p.m. at Halverson Beach in Nevis. Bring your own chair or beach towel. The nonprofit iLink Minnesota helps those with low vision and blindness by providing technology-based solutions. You may find more information and donate by searching for iLink Minnesota. That is the word I spelled E-Y-E. There is more ahead from Morning Edition here on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Many small religious colleges are in trouble. Enrollments are down. Budgets are not balanced. And some people are skeptical about higher education and religion. Almost 80 nonprofit colleges have closed or merged since 2020, and more than half were religiously affiliated. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports on two Catholic colleges in Iowa that decided to merge and join the trend of religious schools seeking strength in numbers.
Tonight, the Mount Mercy Mustangs face off against the St. Ambrose Bees in men's volleyball. The Mustangs have home turf here in Cedar Rapids, and they're having a great season. But the Bees are hanging in. The first set is a nail-biter, 20 to 25. These two Catholic colleges, about 90 minutes away from each other in eastern Iowa, are rivals. But they're also quite similar. They're small and private, they're religious, and they've each been around for a century. Ultimately, Mount Mercy crushed St. Ambrose. But while they compete against each other, coming together, it might actually end up saving them.
We have watched peer institutions right around us shut their doors.
Amy Novak is the president at St. Ambrose University.
Cardinal Stritch was in our athletic conference, and Trinity International was in our athletic conference, and Iowa Wesleyan is not far from either of us and recently closed.
A mix of financial and demographic challenges are at play. Fewer high school graduates means fewer college applicants, especially in rural areas and especially in the Midwest. There has also been a long decline in the share of adults who consider themselves religious.
To watch universities close across the heartland because we can't make it work will leave our communities fallow.
It's not that either school is in trouble yet.
Both of us had reasonably good balance sheets.
They both had good endowments.
So we were really trying to say, how do we do this before it gets really bad?
The presidents of these two rival schools decided to meet on neutral territory at a Perkins restaurant. Turns out, Mount Mercy's president, Todd Olson, was of similar mind.
We were certainly not at the edge of closing, but we were looking at a multi-year model that said, it's going to be hard for us to sustain this.
As more religious colleges close or face financial trouble, partnerships, shared services, and other kinds of alliances appear to be the saving grace. And Olson was interested, and he was willing to be out of a job to do it.
It was clear to me that the time to pursue this was, when we didn't yet absolutely need to pursue this.
Together, they wrote the seeds of the merger on a napkin. They'd have one president, one administration, one combined library system to cut down on costs, and they'd expand academic offerings since each college has different program strengths. That plan will go into effect in 2026.
So in this scenario, we have a patient who has severe respiratory distress.
On the day we visited Mount Mercy's campus in Cedar Rapids, first-year nursing students were practicing patient simulations.
Chloe, which one needed to be given first?
Albuterol.
Professor Kathy Penn was leading the assessment.
Albuterol, and why was that?
Because she needs it right now for her shortness of breath.
Okay, both campuses have strong nursing programs, but the merger will expand their degree offerings.
The fluticasone is a corticosteroid.
Mount Mercy, for instance, offers a master's and a doctorate in nursing. St. Ambrose offers a master's program in physician assistant studies and a doctorate in occupational therapy.
What do you like about this campus?
I love how small it is and how connected everything is.
Junior Elena Bina walks with me and producer Janet Wujong Lee out of the nursing building and across campus. She's wearing a gold horse necklace.
This is Sally the Mustang. So that's our mascot.
Mount Mercy was her first college choice. She loves the culture. There's only about 1,500 students here.
It's very peaceful.
Like a lot of students we talk to, Bina found the idea of combining with St. Ambrose nerve-wracking.
Knowing that it's not just Mount Mercy anymore is like kind of hard.
Why is it hard? It's just an identity change. It's like not what you signed up for. Like, what is hard about it?
You come to a school and you know that it's going to be Mount Mercy. Then you have to think about it like, oh, it's going to change.
On St. Ambrose's campus in Davenport, Iowa, which hosts about 2,500 students, school spirit also runs deep.
Go Bees all the time, yeah.
More than half of the students here play organized sports.
I really wanted to find a place where I could swim and study engineering, and this was the only place that offered me both.
Khalil Ruiz is a senior at St. Ambrose, originally from Ohio. Swim team defined his college experience, and it's how he met his girlfriend, Riley Steinkamp, who got him involved in campus ministry.
Honestly, it's more rare for me to find someone who's not a student athlete, so.
They both hold up their pinky fingers and smile at each other.
We're the fighting bees, so we pinkies up, stingers up. Go Bees.
How could the bees cheer for the Mustangs and vice versa? Well, they won't have to. One of the key aspects of the merger, they'll keep two sports teams, two mascots, to preserve each campus's separate identity. Combining teams, Todd Olson knew,
that would not be wise at all from a business perspective. It is a powerful enrollment driver.
Ruiz and Steinkamp will be back next year cheering for the Bees. And they're also happy that the traditions of St. Ambrose, like 9 p.m. Wednesday Mass at the chapel, the school's most popular, will be safeguarded by this new partnership. The two swimmers join about 100 other students.
Holy, holy, holy Lord.
Tonight, they pray
for the anxious and the afraid,
for the poor and the hungry,
Lord, hear our prayer,
and for the upcoming merger,
for St. Ambrose and Mount Mercy University, that the grace of the Holy Spirit may help us to follow God's plan for our new partnership. We pray to the Lord.
Whether or not it's God's plan,
Lord, hear our prayer.
Campus leaders believe it's a necessary plan, and hopefully one that will ensure both campuses are around for another 100 years.
Amen.
Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News, Eastern Iowa.
Alyssa's story was produced in partnership with the Hechinger Report, a nonprofit independent news organization, and with reporting help from James Kelly at Iowa Public Radio. This is NPR News.
Sometimes a song isn't just a song. It's an idea, a rallying cry, or even an expression of identity. This Independence Day, we'll revisit our 2018 series looking at the music that helped make America.
Whenever I hear it, it stops me in my tracks, and it makes me reflect on the goodness of man.
I'm Elsa Chang, looking back at our American Anthem series on All Things Considered from NPR News.
A You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on KAXE. Your local host will be Andrew DeZingle. It is 6:29. Thanks for listening to the Friday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, National Native News. Support comes from the Bonner Eye Clinic with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. We have a chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms throughout the day today. Otherwise, mostly sunny and warm, highs 88 to 92.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. In a 6-3 ruling this week, the Oklahoma Supreme Court says a Native citizen living on her reservation isn't exempt from state income tax. The Journal Record reports that Alicia Strobel, a member of the Muskogee Nation, had argued that her income was exempt because she lived and worked on her tribe's land. In 2020, Strobel had filed 3 Oklahoma individual income tax returns for the 3 previous years. She said the U.S. Supreme Court decision in the case McGirt versus Oklahoma supported her stance, as that ruling reaffirmed the existence of the Muskogee Nation's reservation. 2 years later, the Oklahoma Tax Commission denied her exemption, leading to an appeal and the case making it up to the state's highest court. The definition of Indian country was deliberated in oral arguments last year. The Oklahoma justices said McGirt doesn't apply to state tax law. In an opinion, they said that extending McGirt to preempt Oklahoma from taxing the income of tribal members residing on unrestricted, non-trust private fee land must come from the nation's highest court. Governor Kevin Stitt praised the ruling, saying he rejects race-based tax exemptions. Tribal leaders have denounced the ruling as inconsistent and a form of legal gymnastics. The Muskogee Nation said they are reviewing their next steps. Several coastal Arctic communities hosted festivals throughout June to celebrate a successful whaling season. In Ukagavik, that meant 4 full days of sharing food, prayers, dance, and traditional blanket toss. It also meant gathering as a community in joy and in loss. Alona Nyden with the Alaska Desk has more. And a note to listeners, the story discusses suicide.
Whaler Quincy Adams soars above a seal blanket at Simmons Field in Utqiagvik with a bag of candy in his hands. He leaps even higher and tosses the kaleidoscope of sweets as the children around him whoop with joy and catch treats. Adams is one of the captains of the Olic whaling crew. They were among those who landed a bowhead whale this spring and threw a feast for the community.
Make sure everybody gets a bite to eat. Make sure that nobody goes hungry.
Nalukatak, which means blanket toss in Inupiaq, is a traditional celebration of the successful bowhead harvest. The whaling crews serve several courses of subsistence dishes throughout the event. Caribou, duck and geese soup, donuts, boiled whale meat, muktuk, akutak, and the delicacy, fermented whale meat and blubber, or mikigak. When the feast is over, the whalers stretch a sealskin blanket, inviting everyone to jump on it. Then the crowd moves indoors and continues with the Inupiaq dancing and drumming throughout the night. This year's Nalukatak had an emotional side for Adams. A young member of their crew died by suicide earlier this year, and the crew opened the event with a prayer and a message of hope.
This is something we wanted to get out to the other people and to the young people and the teens, tell them that there is hope, there is family that loves them, and if they need to talk to somebody, talk to somebody.
Whaling Captain Herman Aksuak says that dedicating Nalukatak to those who passed is not new. He says the event is about the community coming together.
You put on the blanket and jump and let it all out on the blanket and just jump for joy.
The communities of Wainwright, Kaktovik, Nuiqsut, and Point Hope also celebrated whaling festivals in June. In Anchorage, I am Alona Nyden.
If you or someone you know is in crisis, call or text the 988 Suicide Crisis Lifeline. And this Saturday, Minnesota's first ever Native American food truck festival kicks off in St. Paul. Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine says more than 20 Native food trucks will serve up both traditional and urban indigenous fair foods at Harriet Island Regional Park. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Arctic Encounter 2025. An Arctic policy and business event, July 30th to August 1st, that explores community resilience,
critical infrastructure and traditional knowledge. Registration at arcticencounter.com. Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
With us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning.
So the current agreement for how states share the Colorado is now more than 100 years old, and the federal government set a deadline for a new one to be signed by next year. Now, you've reported that it has seemed unlikely that they'd meet that deadline, but now you're telling us it looks like they might?
Yeah, like you said, climate change is making the river smaller, and the states that use it, they know they have to use less, but they have been stuck on one big question. You know, who exactly should have to cut back? You've got the mountain states where the river starts. That's Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico. And the downstream states, California, Arizona, and Nevada. And for more than a year now, talks between those two groups had basically been at a total standstill.
But your sources involved in the negotiations are telling you that the states and the upper and lower basins have now reached some kind of a compromise.
Yeah, up until now, states were really digging in their heels. Some of them were trying to find legal loopholes that would let them skirt around big new cutbacks. Some were trying to stick to century-old rules that were written when the river had a lot more water in it. But now we are seeing a big shift in philosophy. They are considering a new plan that would look at how much water is actually in the river each year and give each side a percentage of that. And this is a pretty big deal. The top water negotiator in Arizona said before he was worried the states would end up in big, messy lawsuits. Now he says he's optimistic they are going to avoid that.
Well, that is big. So while the states have been sorting out their differences, the Trump administration in June tapped the new person to represent the federal government in this process. His name is Ted Cook. He was nominated to run the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. What do we know about him?
Well, Cook spent more than two decades with the Central Arizona Project, which brings water from the Colorado River to Phoenix and Tucson. And by all accounts, he is a qualified technical expert. People who worked with him say he's thorough and deliberative and a good mediator for negotiations like the ones we're seeing now. But some people are a little worried. Those upstream states are concerned he could be biased. Basically, they don't want the top federal agency for the Colorado River being run by a guy who spent his whole career on one side of the debate about how to share it.
I want to mention that Cook still faces confirmation by the Senate. By the way, has he had anything to say about concerns that he may be biased?
Yeah, he did. I got in touch with him over the phone, and he said, look, if we want someone with intimate knowledge of the Colorado River in the federal government, it will inherently have to be someone who has worked on it before, which probably means someone who has worked on one side of debates about the river.
I don't really appreciate being prejudged by folks saying, oh, he's just going to be a lower basin or an Arizona partisan. I call that projection.
There's no confirmation hearing for Cook scheduled quite yet, but in the meantime, states are still meeting pretty frequently. They are starting to agree in principle about sharing this smaller river. But figuring out exactly how much each state gets, that is going to be the next big question.
That is Alex Hager with member station KUNC. Alex, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Elon Musk's business empire has had a rocky year so far, with one notable exception. Most satellite internet traffic goes through his satellite internet service, Starlink. How did Starlink become so dominant, and can it stay that way? Our colleagues Darian Woods and Waylon Wong at The Indicator report.
Starlink is the satellite internet service provided by SpaceX. You buy one of these terminals, which looks kind of like a silver iPad. You set it up facing the sky. And then almost anywhere in the world, you can have high-speed internet.
Satellite communications analyst Tim Farah says Starlink is top dog.
So Starlink has over 7,000 satellites in orbit today. The next biggest system is OneWeb, which has just over 600 satellites launched to date.
So how did one company become the provider of satellite internet? A big explanation is what's known as fixed costs. These are the costs before you add on more customers. So let's go through what's required to get the very first customer onto satellite internet.
You need licenses from the Federal Communications Commission.
Then you have to build satellites.
back of the envelope, we'll probably need a couple of dozen satellites to ensure continuous service.
Then you find a rocket to get it up there. And even then, you're not done. You need to have a factory to build what's called a terminal. This is what the user has, basically the satellite dish and the modem.
So between the licenses, the satellites, and the terminal factories, the fixed costs of satellite internet are really high. What is cheaper is what's known as the variable costs. Once you've added one customer, you've got one customer in place, adding a second or a third one doesn't cost you that much extra.
What's interesting about industries with those characteristics is that these tend to be natural monopolies. That means the more customers a company gets, the cheaper it becomes for them to provide that service. One company naturally becomes a monopoly.
And so we wanted to know, is Starlink a natural monopoly for satellite internet?
Yes, I think that's right. It's a natural monopoly in satellite communications, very clearly.
Starlink wasn't the first internet satellite company, but it's been the first to really invest at this enormous scale and make it accessible to everyday people.
And because Starlink is owned by SpaceX, that means cheaper rocket launches than the prices its competitors have to pay.
So with more satellites in orbit, that gives you more bandwidth. The more bandwidth you have, the more customers you can have. And the more customers you have, that helps you bring down costs through the magic of what's called economies of scale. Having a dominant company innovating and using those economies of scale is all well and good until that monopoly does begin to care about profits and raises prices on customers who have no other choice. That's why a lot of utilities like power and natural gas are regulated by the government. There are limits to how much they can squeeze customers.
Then there's the question of how much power one unelected person should hold. Elon Musk refused to let Ukraine extend Starlink to the contested territory of Crimea. Ukraine has been frustrated with this. Its military uses Starlink.
For partly this reason, China and the European Union are encouraging their own satellite internet. But any competitors have to grapple with the fact that Starlink is part of Elon Musk's empire. And that means the usual principles of finance don't apply. Weilin Wong,
Darian Woods, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward.
This is NPR News.
People of northern Minnesota that power KAXE.
I'm a member because I feel a sense of belonging being part of KAXE, because I know that they are representing me and the communities and people in our area and the work that we're doing in such a truthful and honest way. I love being able to share it nationally and tell people I've met across the nation, like, you can understand more about what it's like to live in northern Minnesota by listening online. There's so much that is of value to people anywhere. It's just an honor to contribute and be part of it.
Help us out. Tell us why you are a member. Text us at 218-326-1234 and keep KEXE powered. We're independent, we're local, we're not run by corporations, the government, or a national network. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
From the station and from the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. A lot of reality TV revolves around nasty behavior on screen, but the producers of one hit reality series are pleading for a little more kindness off screen. Recently, the producers of the dating competition show Love Island USA made a request to its fans stop cyberbullying contestants on the series. According to host Ariana Maddox, some viewers have been posting nasty messages on contestants' social media accounts and then even tracking them down and sharing their personal information. So is online trolling simply the price of reality TV fame, or is it a problem the industry needs to take a little more seriously? And a warning to our listeners, portions of this 3-minute or so conversation address suicide. Brittany Luce joins us now to chat about this. She's the host of NPR's It's Been a Minute podcast and something about Love Island USA expert. So Brittany, for those who have not seen Love Island, tell us what it is and what people find so appealing about it.
Okay, so Love Island is this phenomenal reality TV show that involves a bunch of sexy young singles that are kind of essentially trapped in a villa and try to find love so that the winning couple can hopefully win $100,000. Microphones are worn by the contestants and the cameras are hidden all around the villa. And so they're constantly bringing in new people called bombshells, who are young hotties that get pumped in at random to shake things up. It's a lot of fun.
So the show that then, I guess, thrives on audience participation, too. Viewers vote for their favorite islanders, as they're called, and they vote for who should get together, who should break up. So how has that audience participation crossed the line into something of a concern?
One of the things that's unique about Love Island is that it almost runs in real time. And so the producers, they kind of rely on that audience participation, whether it's voting on polls or voting for who they want to be eliminated in the Love Island app. But this season, things have definitely crossed a line. There have been a few contestants who have had their high school yearbook photos looked up so that, you know, audience members wanted to see or I guess guess what year they might have gotten plastic surgery.
Do you have any maybe theories as to why people engage in this kind of behavior, specifically within reality TV fandom? I mean, it's all supposed to be about fun, right?
It is supposed to be about fun, but a lot of audience members either feel overly familiar or fail to see these reality TV stars as real people. And I think that's when the real trouble starts.
Yeah, two people who appeared on the UK version of Love Island died by suicide in 2018 and 2019, respectively. A former host of the show also took her own life in 2020, and that led to the British Parliament launching an inquiry into the ethics of reality TV. What do you think the show's US producers can learn from all that?
It seems to me that they're already trying to apply some of that. You know, they did release a statement basically pleading with demanding essentially audience members to stop harassing contestants who, I will say, when they are in the villa, they do not have any access to the outside world. Very often it's their friends and family members who are manning their social media accounts. And I think that is a big important step that the U.S. production has taken. I think speaking directly with the audience seems to be at least one outgrowth of the lessons, the sad lessons that have been learned from the U.K. production.
Brittany Luce is the host of NPR's It's Been a Minute podcast. Brittany, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Love Island USA streams on Peacock, and if you'd like to hear more of Brittany Luce, you can find her hosting NPR's It's Been a Minute anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. This is NPR News.
Thank you for listening to the Friday Morning Show on KAXE. Happy 4th of July. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 6:49. Support for KAXE comes from Great Lakes Aquarium with its new exhibit, Lava to Lakes, offering a discovery into what was here before the land we call Minnesota, including sharks, jellyfish, and giant prehistoric fish. Hours and tickets at glaquarium.org. We also thank the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at coleranebank.com, member FDIC. You can find ways to celebrate America's independence throughout northern Minnesota with KAXE's guide to fireworks and parades. Find that at kaxe.org. There is a chance for some scattered showers and thunderstorms today, otherwise mostly sunny, highs in the upper 80s to low 90s and breezy south winds. Showers and thunderstorms possible tonight, lows in the low 70s. For tomorrow, chance of showers and thunderstorms, once again partly sunny and a bit cooler with highs in the low to mid 80s. Looking ahead to Sunday, 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s. Pequot Lakes Community Theater presents Roald Dahl's Willy Wonka, July 11th through the 20th at Pequot Lakes High School Theater. Friday shows at 7 p.m., Saturday and Sunday shows at 2. And the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources offers the Lawns to Legumes program, which aims to increase habitat for at-risk pollinators in residential settings. The deadline to apply for the 2026 season is November 30th. Find more info and apply at bluethumb.org. There's more ahead from Morning Edition here on People Powered KAXE.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. About 2 years ago, buses full of migrants began arriving in New York City. Now, you might remember the images, people waiting on the streets of Manhattan to be processed at the Roosevelt Hotel, which city officials had turned into an intake center and shelter. That hotel became a symbol of the massive wave of immigration under the Biden administration, and now it's closing its doors permanently. NPR correspondent Jasmine Gartz joins us now. So you're one of the few reporters allowed into the hotel. What do you remember about that time?
Oh my God, the heat. I spent a lot of time in 2023 in this really muggy New York City heat, right around this time of year. And I was in line with people who had recently been allowed across the U.S.-Mexico border and then came to New York. And one of the first people I spoke to was an Ecuadorian man named Jose Luis. He asked that his last name be withheld because he'd fled cartel violence. And he had been sleeping on the sidewalk of the Roosevelt Hotel for 4 days waiting for intake.
Nosotros lo que realmente necesitamos.
And what he told me is, look, all I'm asking for is a room to stay in until I can find work, and then I'm going to get my own place.
Now, these people are coming a long way from at least the southern border all the way to New York. So how are they getting to the Roosevelt?
Yeah, so a lot of it was word of mouth. You know, people had been told there were jobs and there was shelter in New York. But also, Texas Governor Greg Abbott sent over 37,000 immigrants to New York City on buses as like a political statement. In some ways, this was a crisis by design.
Now, you spent a lot of time inside the actual hotel, the Roosevelt. What did you see in there?
It was so wild to be in there. It's like a very swanky 1920s style hotel with chandeliers and wide staircases. And then there were also interpreters, healthcare workers scrambling to help. It really did feel like a modern day Ellis Island. And the families I spent time with were extremely eager to get jobs and move on with life. You know, one of my favorite reports that I've ever done was about a Girl Scout troop for migrant kids living in shelters like Roosevelt.
Make new friends, but keep the old.
That's the troupe singing. It was a bunch of 9 and 10-year-old kids who'd done these very traumatic, long treks up Latin America through the Darien Gap, and were now learning English and American civics.
Wow. What happened to the people living at the Roosevelt?
Well, you know, soon after it opened, New York City leaders said, listen, we're overwhelmed. But this year, border crossings are at a historic low. So migrants aren't coming into shelters at the same rate. And the city says it's relocated the remaining families to other shelters.
Okay. Now, I remember the Roosevelt being like this flashpoint in public opinion on immigration. I mean, has that opinion changed since it first opened?
Yeah. You know, the hotel became a talking point for Republicans. It was discussed as a hotbed for crime. There was really no evidence of this. But at the time, a historic number of Americans, over half, felt that the U.S. needed to decrease immigration rates. A new poll out this week by NPR and PBS found that 54% of Americans feel immigration enforcement has now gone too far.
That's NPR's Jasmine Garz, an immigration correspondent for NPR. Jasmine, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
For this Independence Day, we asked our listeners to think about freedom. Here is some of what you told us.
My name is Michael Morton. I live in West Michigan, and I'm a general manager of an automotive plant. Freedom to me is, you know, the freedom to make your own way as best you can. I just wish people would slow down for a minute and think about what freedoms they have. I have the freedom, you know, to choose where I work. That's a freedom that doesn't exist everywhere in the world. I have the freedom to pick who I'm marrying, how many children I'm allowed to have. And we can disagree and we can criticize the government, and we have a lot of leeway here in this country.
My name is Tyler Roth, and I live in Hood River, Oregon. Freedom to me is that everyone should be able to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Nobody should be inflicting on everyone else's thoughts, ideas, religions. Everyone should be free to express themselves. Every time I drive to work, there's a guy on the corner with a giant sign that says, God is great, and looking for honks. And then there's an awesome trans lady that works at my local grocery store. There shouldn't be any reason why these can't exist together.
My name is Diane Evia Lonavie, and I live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Freedom to me means the ability to live in a country without fear of persecution for something that you might say, who you are, who you love, what you believe in. I grew up hearing about freedom through my parents' stories from Cuba and their decision to bring my brother and me out of the country, fleeing communism. A country like ours could and should allow refugees to come in to seek asylum. And it makes me really sad. We arrived in this country 59 years ago, and we would not be admitted into this country today.
My name is Tawny Thompson, and I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So I am a member of a group called the Janesville Fife and Drum Corps. We reenact the Virginia Regiment, who would have fought in the Revolutionary War under the command of General George Washington. On the 3rd and the 4th, we get together and we do 7 parades in 2 days. And we have a color guard with flags and muskets. We have a group of fifers, and a fife is a colonial wooden flute that's very, very high pitched so that it could be heard over battlefields. I think it's important to reflect on what our founding fathers were really fighting for when they decided to rebel against King George III and England at the time, which is really just the freedom for people in this country to be able to live their lives and make choices for themselves and their families without fear of persecution.
The Janesville Fife and Drum Corps on Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music is inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez.
It is a minute before 7 o'clock. Good morning. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for tuning in this 4th of July morning. We do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms today, especially this afternoon. Otherwise, mostly sunny and warm. Highs in the upper 80s to low 90s and breezy south winds. Showers and thunderstorms possible tonight. Lows near 70. And for tomorrow, chance of showers and thunderstorms continue. Partly sunny, highs in the low to mid 80s. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. We continue with Morning Edition on KAXE.